Hello, Dreamers. This is a re-release of an older episode. This is the first time that I've ever had to do this. It was a bonus episode from October of 2018 entitled The Tale of the Castle Doctrine. I was asked to take the episode down. It was one that was suggested to me by a listener, but someone closely related to the story took issue with the episode. So I took down the version where I thanked the listener for recommending this to me, and I am re-recording it and retelling it as The Tale of Brandon Ketstever and The Castle Doctrine. I feel these stories are important lessons, especially for young people who might be getting into mischief or pranking. I think it serves as a cautionary tale and as a reminder to our kids and young people that they really need to think things through before they act. They need to go with their better judgment, and they have to remember that they're not immortal. I'm going to edit this way down and get to the heart of what the story is about. There were actually two stories that I told in this particular episode, both of them involving armed homeowners protecting their property. So, let's get started. I'm going to first tell you about a young man named Brandon Ketstever. He was 17 years old and a senior at John F. Kennedy High School in La Palma, California. He was popular. He played sports, including football, water polo. He ran track. He was also an occasional prankster, according to his family and friends. But on October 19, 1999, tragedy struck when Brandon was shot in the head while driving his car in the city of Buena Park, California. He had two other passengers in the car who were uninjured. Your initial thought might be that this was some sort of random shooting, possibly a road rage incident, and somebody in another car opened fire. It was not uncommon for things like that to happen in Southern California, and it still happens. It seems to be happening more frequently lately for some reason. There are going to be shootings like this, drive-by type of things, and sometimes they're gang-related, sometimes they're not. But Brandon and his friends didn't seem to be the types of kids that would find themselves in that sort of trouble. But this was not a drive-by shooting. This wasn't a result of a road rage incident. Brandon was driving his car with his two friends when he was shot one time in the head by a homeowner, a 47-year-old Buena Park resident named Pete Tavita Salamona. Brandon was driving past Salamona's home. Okay, and so what? This guy came out of his house and opened fire on a carload of teenagers? Well, that's not the complete story. As we delve into exactly what happened and the reasons why it happened, you're probably going to find yourself shaking your head at the senselessness of it all. It will have you wondering how this one man's anger and frustration had escalated to a point that would bring about an act of homicidal violence over something that you are going to find to be so incredibly petty. Salamona, up until the evening of this tragedy, this evening when he came out of his home armed with a loaded .357 Magnum revolver, was, by all accounts, the kindest of neighbors, a devoted family man, a loving grandfather. When his gun fired that single bullet that struck Brandon, Salamona would later claim that his gun went off accidentally. But then, one of the golden rules of gun ownership is don't take your gun out and point it unless you intend to use it. It's a matter of safety. So, to Salamona's claim that it went off accidentally, it speaks to that point. You just don't brandish your weapon, don't point it at anyone unless you intend to use it and are prepared to kill somebody. According to witnesses at the scene of the shooting, Salamona froze in the middle of the street the moment the gun went off. They described him as being in a daze. He was stunned and he kept saying over and over again that it just went off. It just went off. Salamona's daughter rushed over to the vehicle to check on the injured. A neighbor called 911 to report the shooting. Salamona called 911 to report himself, telling the operator that he just shot someone, but insisted that it was a terrible accident. The shooting of Brandon Ketstever that evening shocked this quiet Orange County neighborhood nestled less than a mile away from Knott's Berry Farm. Neighbors, witnesses, and bystanders described the scene as chaotic. And for years to come, the community would struggle with two questions. How could something like this have happened? And was their community ever going to be the same? So what did happen that night? Why was Brandon Ketstever shot to death? What in the world could have led to all of this in this typically quiet bedroom community? Well, unfortunately, it was something so simple, something that has happened plenty of times to plenty of people in plenty of neighborhoods. Brandon and his two friends were driving around in their car that night, specifically looking for Halloween decorations to steal. The three of them were in the car, slowly cruising around, circling the neighborhood, and they claimed that they were trying to steal decorations from their friends' houses as just a prank. Whether these kids were looking to steal from their friends' houses or if they were looking to steal from any random houses they could have found decorations at, who can say for sure? I mean, I suppose if you label it as pranking your friends, it sort of minimizes the crime or the vandalism in a way. It's okay, they're friends, they do it to each other. No big deal, right? As opposed to trespassing onto a stranger's property and stealing something. I also was never really clear if Brandon or any of his friends even knew the Salamono family or if they had kids the same age or their kids attended the same school. But just based on the fact that Salamona came out of his house and opened fire on these boys, I sort of leaned towards the parties not really being acquainted with one another. Salamona told detectives that he noticed that one of his Halloween decorations was missing sometime around 8:45 that evening and that he witnessed Brandon and his friends drive away from his home. He said they circled back around a few minutes later, and that is when Salamona grabbed his gun, he came out of his home, and he confronted the teens as they pulled up alongside the street in front of his house. According to one of the teens in the car, Salamona shouted something to the effect of, "What the hell are you doing? Why did you steal my pumpkin?" And from there, they said Salamona began banging his hand that he was holding the gun with either on the roof of the car or on the window of their car. They had apparently taken a 3.5-foot or 1-meter tall decoration from Salamona's front yard. According to another witness at the scene, one or more of the teens inside the car said something that was meant to be a taunt aimed at Salamona. "What are you going to do about it?" It was only a matter of seconds after the start of this confrontation that Salamona's gun fired one shot, striking Brandon in the head. The other two teens in the car quickly opened their doors and fled from the vehicle, screaming, "You've killed him. What have you done?" Salamona's daughter approached the vehicle and attempted to help Brandon, urging him to hang on, to stay alive. Neighbors looked on in shock and horror as she continued to encourage Brandon to stay with it, that help was coming. First responders arrived shortly thereafter, and Brandon was rushed to UCI Medical Center, which is several miles southeast of Buena Park in the city of Orange. Doctors scrambled to save Brandon's life, doing all that they could, but he was mortally wounded. Brandon Ketstever succumbed to his injuries the following morning at 3:12 a.m. Salamona said the shooting was an accident, but I have to ask, why in the world did he get so bent out of shape over a Halloween decoration? And back when I first wrote this episode, I wrote about some of the frustrations that I have felt about the annoying and mischievous things that teenagers are capable of. At the time, I lived near a high school, and when school was dismissed each day, they'd come through the neighborhood and through the park like a wave of loud, obnoxious kids. They were on foot, they were on skateboards, they were on bikes. I've seen them loitering around my car. Sometimes they're leaning on it. They litter, they vandalize things with graffiti. And also, if ever a kid sees some sort of fresh cement that's been poured or something freshly painted, you can almost be certain that they're going to touch it or write on it or otherwise deface it. It's inevitable. Also, at the time when I first wrote this story back in 2018, I mentioned that I had decorated the front porch at my place for Halloween, and I hammered a decorative sign into the grass near the walkway that led up to my porch, and it said something like trick or treat on it or whatever. I had just bought everything that day and I decorated, and it was very close to the time that I did this episode because it was meant to be a Halloween episode. Well, the next morning, my sign was gone. Somebody had come up close to my porch and took my sign. So yeah, I know kids and teenagers can be super annoying. I also referred back to the 12th episode of California Dreaming in a case involving the killing of Sharice Iverson committed by Jeremy Strohmeyer. And I talked about how he and his friends would drive around Long Beach with a BB gun and shoot homeless people in the buttocks. I pointed out how sometimes these teenagers are bored and spoiled and overindulged and undersupervised. And they do these things because they think they're funny, but it really crosses the line of being just cruel. And shooting a BB gun at someone is more than just a prank. It's pretty serious. And these are things that some teenagers think is really hilarious. And if it is something that you deal with on a regular basis, or if there's a kid or a group of kids that habitually do things to you or to your property for their own amusement, the frustration can really build. These people, they've had it with these kids because they're just fed up. I don't know how much or how little Salamona had been a target of teenage pranks, but for him to come out with a gun like that, it gets you thinking that this guy must have been driven to his breaking point or something. But then again, it could have been the one and only time that Salamona's home had ever been targeted and he just lost it. We just don't know. And the whole thing had reminded me of the story out of Little Falls, Minnesota. A homeowner named Byron David Smith got fed up with kids breaking into his home, and he decided to quote unquote clean up the mess himself. His case had more of a backstory, but the end result was the same. He got fed up with kids messing around and stealing his property. And I'm sure all of you remember the case, but I'm going to go over it a little bit more when I'm finished here telling you about Brandon's killing. So Salamona was arrested and booked into the Orange County Jail in Santa Ana on suspicion of murder. And he would go on to stand trial a total of 3 times. In the first trial, he was convicted of murder. But a judge later threw out that decision, citing that the instructions to the jury that were given were flawed. A second trial ended in a hung jury. And then in Salamona's third trial, the jurors deliberated the case for 4 days before reaching a verdict in May of 2002, more than 2.5 years after Brandon's death. And that jury found Salamona guilty of involuntary manslaughter. In August of that year, he was sentenced to 6 years in prison, which was less than the maximum of 11 years that the then 50-year-old Salamona was facing. Reaching an appropriate punishment for Salamona consumed the lives of everyone involved in this case for several years, not to mention the lives of 3 juries in 3 trials, but all sides stated that they were relieved that the legal drama was finally over with once a verdict was rendered. During the sentencing hearing, Salamona's wife turned to Brandon's family and apologized. Brandon's parents urged the court to impose the maximum sentence, having some poster-sized pictures of Brandon set up inside the courtroom. There was one of him swinging a baseball bat, one of him wearing swim goggles, one of him in a football uniform, and one in a tuxedo the night he attended prom. His parents stated at the sentencing hearing that Brandon never had a mean bone in his body. The one time that he did something that he should not have done, he was murdered for it. Their son paid with his life. Their friends and families will be paying for the rest of their lives. Orange County Superior Court Judge Richard Tuohy said that he was trying to strike a balance in the sentencing, stating, "I'm not going to give anyone a break here or send a message. The conduct of Mr. Salamona has left 2 families in ruins. He acted in disregard for life." Deputy District Attorney Caroline Raines stated that she hopes this case sends a message stating, "The only thing that can give meaning to this death is that the next time a person gets angry at another person or disrespects them or cuts them off on the freeway, they have to remember that it is wrong to react in a way that places someone's life in danger." Salamona's attorney felt that the sentence was too harsh, stating, "We felt this was a probation case. It's the most this man deserved. It was an accident, so it bothers me." He used the gun to get attention, not in a threatening manner. So Salamona was led out of the courtroom and immediately remanded into custody. His family told him that they loved him. Brandon's family left the courtroom stating that they were glad that this was over. And by the way, Dreamers, that Halloween decoration was a pumpkin garbage bag, that the kind that you can fill up with leaves and tie up at the end and set it on your lawn to look like a large stuffed jack-o'-lantern. So a moment ago, I mentioned Little Falls, Minnesota, and a resident named Byron David Smith. On Thanksgiving Day of 2012, he shot two teenagers to death. They were cousins Haley Elaine Kiefer and Nicholas Alexander Brady, and they were in the process of breaking into Smith's home. Haley was 18 years old at the time of her death. She was born October 17, 1994. She was a native of Little Falls and was a senior in high school. She was the daughter of Jay and Jenny Kiefer. From the time Haley was in kindergarten, one of her favorite sports was wrestling, and she was a stats keeper for her school's wrestling team. She also enjoyed gymnastics, diving, softball, and cross country. Those who knew her described her as a very competitive person. No matter what sport she was participating in, giving up or quitting was never an option, even when she sustained injuries. She enjoyed the outdoors, including hunting, fishing, camping, and spending quality time with her family and friends. She worked part-time at a variety of different places in Little Falls, including the local movie theater, KFC, Pizza Ranch, and Myers. Nicholas was 17 years old at the time of his death. He was born March 21st, 1995, and was also a native of Little Falls and was a junior in high school. He was a son of Jason and Kimberly Brady. Like his cousin Haley, he also was athletic. He enjoyed wrestling, taekwondo, strength and fitness training, hunting, fishing, camping, four-wheeling, and tinkering with his car. Those who knew him said he had a great sense of humor and an inviting smile. He was very family-oriented and spent much of his free time with them. On Thanksgiving Day of 2012, Byron David Smith shot and killed both Nicholas and Haley as they were attempting to break into his house. So let's talk a little bit about what led up to that day. On October 27th, 2012, a little less than a month before Thanksgiving, Smith's home had been burglarized and a number of valuable items were taken, including a shotgun and a rifle. He reported this break-in to the police. It was investigated, but no suspects were ever arrested or charged. Following this burglary, Smith said he began having trouble sleeping. He had been very upset about the break-ins, but this most recent one was especially upsetting since guns were taken. Smith told his neighbor, Bill, that he suspected that the person breaking into his home was a neighbor of his named Ashley, and that her family made a habit of surveilling his home to watch as he came and went. Worried that the burglar would return, knowing that they could be armed with the guns that they stole when they did, Smith began carrying a gun around the house with him at all times. At about 10:30 in the morning on Thanksgiving, November 22nd, 2012, Smith was standing outside of Bill's house, chatting with him, when they both watched as his neighbor Ashley drove by. Smith came to believe that she was the one that was breaking in and robbing him, or at least she was in on it, because among some of the items stolen included clothing, and Smith theorized that only girls would be interested in stealing clothes. About an hour after Smith saw Ashley go by, he went ahead and moved his vehicle and parked it several blocks away. He parked it outside of a home where he said two state troopers had resided. Smith told investigators that he moved his vehicle because he wanted to clean his garage and he wanted to protect his vehicle from being vandalized. After he parked the vehicle, he walked back home at approximately 11:45 a.m., but he walked through his backyard instead of entering through the main entrance of his house. About 15 minutes later, Smith went into his basement and turned on his digital audio recorder. He sat down in his reading chair, which faced the side of the basement staircase. He had with him his book, a bottle of water, and something to snack on. On his belt, he had a 9-shot revolver, and a few feet away from his chair, he had a loaded mini 14 rifle. Smith had an outdoor video surveillance system running, and in an adjacent basement work area, he had a screen that showed him images from his 4 security cameras that were placed around the exterior of his home. So with that bit of information, we know that Smith would have had plenty of time to watch as Nicholas and Haley approached his house and to pick up his phone and contact law enforcement, but he did not do that. Instead, he continued to sit quietly in the basement, and he waited, he watched, and he listened. The following events were captured on Smith's own digital audio recorder. It is worth mentioning that this case may have ended much differently if it weren't for Smith's own audio recordings of what actually happened that day. So in the beginning of the recording, Smith is talking to himself. 11 minutes in, he is heard saying, "In your left eye." 17 minutes in, Smith began rehearsing what he was going to say when he would get ready to report what was about to happen to police, to his neighbor, and to an attorney that he already knows that he's gonna need. On this recording, Smith says, "Bill, stop by tomorrow morning. No rush, but as soon as convenient. Can you do that?" "Yeah, park to the north, 100 feet or 100 yards north of the corner and walk from the west." 23 minutes in, Smith says, "I realize I don't have an appointment, but I would like to see one of the lawyers here." 33 minutes after Smith switched his recorder on, what he had predicted would happen happened. Nicholas Brady approached his house. He looked into the windows and he tried the doorknobs, but they were locked and deadbolted, according to Smith. He heard the sounds of the doorknobs being rattled and he saw a shadow in the window of the basement. He sat there and listened as Nicholas walked across the front porch deck. Then, glass can be heard being broken on the audio recording. This was the sound of Nicholas breaking and entering into Smith's home through a bedroom window. Nicholas quietly approached the basement stairs. Smith was down below waiting unbeknownst to Nicholas. As he descended down the stairs, Smith saw Nicholas's feet first, then his knees, then his hip. Smith opened fire, shooting him in the chest with his rifle. Smith would later tell investigators that he did not see Nicholas's hands when he shot him. Smith shot him a second time, causing Nick to tumble down the stairs and onto the basement floor. He landed face up. 3 seconds later, at close range, Smith shot Nicholas as he lay there moaning. The bullet passed through Nicholas's hand and went into the side of his head, and the moaning stopped. Nicholas went silent. Smith is heard on the audio recording saying, "You're dead." Smith then picked up his shoes, which fell off him when he fell down the stairs, and he placed them under his reading chair. He then grabbed the tarp that he had next to the basement fireplace, and he put Nicholas's body onto the tarp and dragged him over to the adjacent workroom. Once Smith was done, several minutes later, on the audio recording, noises can be heard, and those were the sounds of Smith reloading his rifle. 10 minutes after Nicholas had broken into Smith's house, and 8 minutes after Smith had shot him dead, Haley entered the home. She quietly called out for her cousin, but she got no response. So she too began the descent down the basement stairs, again quietly whispering, "Nick." And just as Smith had described seeing Nicholas come down the stairs, he watched as Haley did the same thing. And he opened fire when he saw her hips, but before seeing her hands. She tumbled down the stairs. Smith attempted to fire at her again, but his rifle jammed. Then Smith said, "Oh, sorry about that." Haley can be heard saying, "Oh my God," as Smith pulled out his revolver from his belt and shot her again. As she was screaming, Smith shot her a third and fourth time. And then he told her, "You're dying." She screamed again, and he shot her a fifth time in the face, next to her left eye, and then called her a bitch. He then dragged her into the adjacent workroom and placed her on top of Nicholas's body. A few minutes later, Smith noticed that Haley wasn't dead, so he shot her a sixth and final time at point-blank range under her chin. The kill shot, as he called it. For the next 5 hours after killing Nicholas and Haley, Smith stayed inside his home with his audio recorder continuing to run, capturing him talking to himself. Some of his statements included the following. "I left my house at 11:30. They were both dead by 1. And dreamers, to me, this means that Smith knew and accurately predicted that these kids would see that his vehicle was gone and that they would break into his house thinking he wasn't home. Smith had also made it a point to slip into his house through the backyard in case anyone was watching. What this also tells me is that he knew that they were expecting nobody to be home. So if they knew or thought nobody was home, then why would they show up armed with any weapons? They didn't break into homes to confront and overtake homeowners. They wanted to sneak in and sneak out. There was no need to bring a gun, especially a shotgun or a rifle. Those are what Smith had reported were stolen. And they weren't going to try to walk around the neighborhood carrying weapons like that. And the fact is, they weren't. Both Haley and Nicholas were unarmed." Smith also said on the recording, "Of course, I'm safe now. Cute. I'm sure she thought she was a real pro. You're dead. I'm not a bleeding heart liberal. I felt like I was cleaning up a mess. Not like spilled food. Not like vomit. Not even like diarrhea. The worst possible mess. And I was stuck with it. In some tiny little respect, I was doing my civic duty. If the law enforcement system couldn't handle it, I had to do it. I had to do it. The law system couldn't handle her. And if it fell into my lap and she dropped her problem into my lap, and she threw her problem in my face and I had to clean it up. They weren't human. I don't see them as human. I see them as vermin. Social mistakes. Social problems. I don't see them as human. This bitch was going to go through her life destroying things for other people. Thieving, robbing, drug use. It's all fun, cool, exciting, highly profitable until somebody kills you. It's a sucker shot. People going down strange stairs naturally watch the steps. Like I give a damn who she is. It's not a mess like spilled food. It's not a mess like vomit. It's not even a mess like diarrhea. It's far worse. Then they take slice after slice out of me. $5,000 slice, $10,000 slice. And if I gather enough evidence, they might be prosecuted. And if they're prosecuted, they might go to court. And if it goes to court, they might be found guilty. And if they're found guilty, they might spend 6 months in jail, 2 years in jail. And then they're out. And then they need money worse than ever. And they're filled with revenge. I cannot live a life like that. I cannot have that chewing on me for the rest of my life. I cannot. I refuse to live with that level of fear in my life. I refuse to live with that level of fear in my life. She's tough. She's eye candy. It's games. It's exciting. It's highly profitable. Until somebody kills you. Until you go too far and somebody kills you. Until you take advantage of somebody who's not a sucker. Mother and father are semi-psychotic. Both semi-psychotic. I put even odds that one or the other will come over here with a gun. Smith did not contact law enforcement on the day that he shot and killed Nicholas and Haley. He said he was sitting there waiting, thinking that maybe her parents would come over with a gun to see what happened, because he was under the impression that he had killed his neighbor's daughter, Ashley. So he sat there, afraid of them coming over, looking for her when she failed to return home, but he was mistaken. This wasn't his neighbor, Ashley. Smith also claimed that he waited until the next day to call because he didn't want to ruin anyone's Thanksgiving. So the following day, Friday, November 23rd, Smith called up his neighbor, Bill, and asked him if he could find an attorney. But it's my understanding that he was unable to contact anyone because offices were closed for the holiday weekend. Later on, Smith asked Bill to contact the sheriff's department, telling him that he just solved the neighborhood break-ins. Bill did call the sheriff's department, and there were a number of conversations between the sheriff's dispatch and the deputies. Obviously, nobody had been told that the two teenagers were shot dead the day before and were lying in pools of blood on a tarp in Smith's basement. Otherwise, I would hope that they would have been there with more urgency about it. Bill requested that the same sergeant who investigated the previous burglaries be the one to respond to Smith's house, which he did a short time later, arriving with another deputy. As the deputies approached Smith's house, he exited through his front door with his hands up. He said that he needed to tell them something, and he led the officers into his home, explaining that he had been the victim of previous burglaries, and the most recent one happened the day before on Thanksgiving. And he showed them the broken glass in his bedroom, and he told them that there was something that he needed to show them in the basement. It is then when he led them downstairs, and that's when they saw the bodies of Nicholas and Haley. He said that he shot a man coming down the steps and that he wanted this person dead and that he shot him until he was certain that he was dead and that he dragged him onto the tarp and then proceeded to wait. And then he shot a woman coming down the stairs, but this time he tried to aim for the heart. Afterwards, he dragged her onto the tarp, but that's when he noticed that she was still gasping for air, so he shot her again. He told the deputies that he suspected that this was his neighbor Ashley. Smith was arrested on the spot and taken into the sheriff's office for questioning. He was read his Miranda rights when he was interrogated. He said that he would talk to the officers. He discussed the burglaries that had occurred at his home prior to the shootings. He explained that for the last month since the burglary where his guns were stolen, that he had been feeling very threatened. When he heard someone coming down the stairs of the basement, he believed them to be the same burglars who stole his guns, stating, "I figured they're willing to use guns if they steal guns, and I decided that I've got a choice of either shooting or be shot at." He described how he shot Nicholas as he came down the stairs, stating, "I saw his feet, then I saw his legs, and when I saw his hips, I shot." Then they asked Smith where Nicholas's hands were, and he said that he did not see his hands. Smith described how Nicholas had been tumbling to the floor and stated, "He's looking face up at me, and I shot him in the face. I wanted him dead." Smith then said that he sat back down in his chair and that his adrenaline was pumping and that he needed to calm down. He next described how he shot Haley in a similar manner in which he shot Nicholas as she came down the stairs. Smith said that he shot her before he saw her hands, and when she fell to the ground, her hands were open, but she would have dropped anything that she was carrying. Smith did say that he wasn't going to ask if they had a gun or not, stating, "You know, people who steal guns, I don't want to give them a chance to shoot me." She could have or might not have had a gun in her hands. Smith next talked more about the reasons why he killed Nicholas and Haley, stating, "And thinking back on it, what happened was everybody has red buttons. Everybody has sore spots. And I've known since grade school that being ganged up on is a sore spot with me. I just wasn't thinking. I didn't think. I wasn't thinking. I was just there ganging up on me, so I killed her too." Smith also said that Haley laughed at him when his rifle jammed. And we all know that isn't true because we heard it on the recording. But Smith said it wasn't a very long laugh because she was already hurting. That's another red button I guess most people would have. So if you're trying to shoot somebody and they laugh at you, you go again. "I fired more shots than I needed to." Smith was asked why he fired more shots than he needed to, and he explained that his gun is a pea shooter and he felt very, very threatened and unhappy. They asked him, "You were mad, correct?" and Smith said yes. After he shot her, he put her on top of Nicholas, and both of them were on the tarp. He said after she was on the tarp, she was still gasping. As much as I hate someone, I don't believe they deserve pain. So I gave her a shot under the chin, up into the cranium. I thought she was dead, and it turned out she wasn't. So I did a good, clean finishing shot. She gave out the death twitch. First time I ever seen it in a human, but it works the same in beaver, deer, whatever. Towards the end of the interrogation, Smith did acknowledge that his moving of his vehicle and parking it away from his home was probably the impetus for the two of them to try and gain entry into the home because they figured that nobody was there. That was the first and only time Smith had ever parked his vehicle in the location that he chose that morning. It was in a place where nobody would be able to see it from his house. Smith was charged with second-degree murder. However, as the investigation went on, his charges were elevated to first-degree murder. At trial, he was charged with both in order to give the jury the possibility of convicting him of the lesser charge if they did not feel his actions rose to the levels of first-degree murder. What the jury would hear is that Smith shot and killed two ordinarily harmless teenagers who just happened to decide to break into his house on Thanksgiving Day. The judge was not going to allow evidence that both Nicholas and Haley had broken into his house or any other houses in the area on any previous occasions. The fact of the matter is Nicholas had never broken into Smith's house before. As for Haley, I'm not 100% sure. The jury would also not hear anything about Nicholas or Haley having been under the influence of any narcotics. Haley's autopsy indicated that she had chemicals in her system associated with cough syrup at the time of her death. So the fact that Haley and Nicholas had been troublemakers wasn't going to make it into court. So the jury wouldn't have any idea of what Smith's state of mind was like when he shot and killed them. But in the end, I don't think it would have mattered because Smith recorded his premeditation on the hours and hours of audio recordings that he provided for investigators. And even if he purposely lured Nicholas and Haley into his home by moving his vehicle, he lost his Castle Doctrine defense the moment that he kept shooting more times than he needed to in order to neutralize that threat. What is the Castle Doctrine defense? I will go over that in a couple of minutes. And the jury agreed with the prosecution that this went beyond defending one's home. He was convicted after only 3 hours of deliberation. The jury convicted him on all the charges, 2 counts of first-degree murder and 2 counts of second-degree murder. The jury said it was the audio tapes that were Smith's undoing. They were able to listen to the ramblings of an extremely deranged person, and that person should never be walking the streets free again. Smith was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. His most recent appeals and motions have all been denied. Today, Smith is 73 years old and he is being housed at the Oak Park Heights Correctional Facility in Stillwater, Minnesota. Byron David Smith will forever feel that his actions were justified. And he does have his defenders. And for a time, this case did have the community of Little Falls divided. I guess the bright side of all of this is that Smith no longer has to live his life in fear. Byron David Smith was a man fed up with these kids. He called them vermin. He had done what he thought he needed to do in terms of filing police reports and setting up security systems around his house, but he apparently was still being victimized and his paranoia continued to grow. Because Smith did not think anything effective was being done to put a stop to these teens burglarizing his home, he decided that he would take care of the problem himself. And if you don't look too deeply into this case, it would seem like a justified shooting. By law, Smith did have the right to defend his home. Several states have laws that allow homeowners to use deadly force when there is a perceived threat. They vary from state to state, but they are typically some variation of the Stand Your Ground laws or Castle Doctrine laws. There is a difference between the two. Castle Doctrine dates back to the 1600s in England. The castle, of course, being a person's home. It gives people the right to protect their homes using deadly force without the obligation to retreat. British citizens hundreds of years ago felt like they needed to protect themselves from any intrusion from the government, by the king, or from any criminal elements. They developed castle doctrine so that everyone could have the right to protect themselves and their family without the fear of criminal prosecution. Castle doctrine has been on the American law books for centuries, and it has always protected citizens who needed to use deadly force to defend their homes. In the 1980s, several states passed what became known as the Make My Day laws, and Make My Day was the catchphrase from Clint Eastwood's 1983 film Sudden Impact. This was in order to give the laws official codes in the states that passed them, making them actual laws on the books, because the castle doctrine just kind of seemed to be something that was understood, that you are allowed to use deadly force if someone breaks into your home and is intending to commit a crime or is posing a threat to you or your family's safety. Even if you have the ability to flee your home, you are not required to do so before using deadly force. Now, if you are outside your home, you may have the duty to retreat. But that same duty does not apply when you are inside your own home. Stand Your Ground laws expanded on the castle doctrine in that it includes the principle of when you are in public. Standing your ground means that you do not have the obligation to retreat from public places where anyone is legally allowed to be. The first state to pass the Stand Your Ground law was Florida. Many of us, I'm sure, remember the high-profile case involving the shooting death of Trayvon Martin by self-proclaimed neighborhood watch person George Zimmerman, who successfully defended his actions. Though he did not use the Stand Your Ground laws, he claimed self-defense, but the case did bring about a national conversation about standing your ground. Zimmerman was not about to use that law because it would have required him to have been in mortal danger, with matching forces being used against him. And while he had a gun, Trayvon only had a drink and some candy. Since it was passed in Florida in 2005, more than half the states in the union have passed similar laws that allow a person to use deadly force in a life-threatening situation. All Stand Your Ground laws stipulate that a person must reasonably believe themselves or another person to be in mortal danger before matching force with force. Self-defense has always been a defense for justifiable homicide, but Standing Your Ground codified it and stipulates that even further, a person does not have the duty to retreat. Standing Your Ground seeks to provide immunity to victims of violent assaults, no matter where that assault takes place. There had been a debate about whether or not Byron David Smith had the right to do what he did. The fact is that Smith had been burglarized a couple times before, so much so that he was basically able to predict that they would be coming back. He figured they would, but at the same time, he also tried to make steps to make sure that they would, and that was parking his vehicle elsewhere to make it appear that the house was empty. But at the same time, he grabbed some snacks and a drink, and he had a book to read. He settled into his comfy armchair he set up in the basement. He had two loaded guns with him, and he had tarps to catch all the mess, right? He turned on his recording devices. He sat there and waited for the burglars to take the bait, and they did. They broke in. He shot them. But the way he went about it, and the planning, and the additional unnecessary shots that he fired to ensure that they were dead, all of that for investigators turned this Castle Doctrine case into a murder case. And Smith even recorded himself saying how he didn't even view them as human, that they were worse than vomit, worse than diarrhea. This is how this man viewed the lives of these two young people. Yes, they were burglarizing his home, but they weren't garbage. And the manner in which he dispatched them, it was uncalled for. And now he's living behind bars for the rest of his life. But even before then, it kind of felt like Byron David Smith was living in the prison of his own mind. So what are your takeaways from these two stories, Dreamers? I would really like it if you shared your thoughts with me on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram. For me, I have to say that kids and grown-ups, they just have to really think about what you're doing and have respect for the people around you and your neighbors and their property, because you just never know if you're going to run into the next Pete Salamoa or Byron David Smith. And for those of us that are here in the United States or anywhere where you have the right to bear arms and defend your home, everyone likes to think that Americans are trigger-happy gun lovers. I'm not going to have anything to say about that right now one way or another, because that isn't really what this is about. But it is what it is. And I hope all of us listening are safe and responsible and accountable for what we do. And to try not to be reckless or petty when it comes to defending ourselves. And our hearts go out to the lives that were senselessly lost in these stories. Brandon Ketstever, Nicholas Brady, and Haley Kiefer. And I want to thank you all for listening. And if this is the first time you've listened to this episode in 3 years, and it's the first time I've listened to it in 3 years too, so. And it's just as sad and as heartbreaking as it was back then. Thank you so much for listening. And until next time, sweet dreams.